House Judiciary Committee on Criminal Law. On Monday, Mr. Podanky was here patiently waiting to testify on certain HJRs, and unfortunately, time ran out, and he was kind enough to agree to return. We do have those HJRs on the agenda today, so we will technically, because it's published as a work session, go into a work session, a combined work session on HJR 87 through 94. And we will invite Mr. Podanky forward to testify. Also, Kathy Osborne. Did you want to come up one after the other? Do you have a preference? All right, Kathy Osborne will come up along with Mr. Podanky. And is there anyone else here who wanted to testify on the HJRs? Raise your hand, please. All right, so it'll be Mr. Podanky and Ms. Osborne. We will not be conducting any further business on these HJRs this morning. We may have a work session tomorrow or Friday, depending on whether amendments are ready and all of that, and if people have a chance to see them. Various amendments have been requested. But we will proceed with this work session so we can allow invited testimony. In the case I didn't hit the gavel on that, we are in work session, and I'll let either one of you go first.
Someone got hungry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Kathy Osborne for Juvenile Rights Project. I'll just go through. I'm going to talk about these based on the juvenile stuff. On HJR 87, Juvenile Rights Project would actually support this if we could finally fix the language problem, which I've discussed previously. I have, at the last time I testified, the chair asked me to give language to counsel on how to fix this, and I did do that. Unfortunately, it still hasn't been fixed.
Well, we discussed it. Go ahead.
The problem, once again, is in subsection 3A, there's the definition of criminal defendant, which includes juveniles. And not to beat a dead horse, when I was driving down here today, I was trying to think of how I could best explain why this is a problem. And I guess the best explanation I have is it'd be similar to putting into the Constitution that for a section in the Constitution, Jewish would include Catholic, Christians, and Protestants. Now, granted they're all religions, and granted all four of those religions worship a God, but I think each one of those religions would say there's very significant differences between them, and the differences between them are significant enough that to be lumped together would cause major problems. And it's the same thing here. This language can be changed so you don't have to use that definition. The other problem with the definition is when you use it, it's still not carrying through the differences in the language in juvenile court. For example, in subsection 1F, where it talks about the right to be consulted upon request regarding plea negotiations involving any violent felony. There are no plea negotiations involving violent felonies in juvenile court. They aren't called plea negotiations because juveniles technically do not plea, and there aren't any violent felonies because technically they have not committed a violent felony. And you can leave this language in, and I'll tell you right now, juvenile attorneys will try to exploit that. It's your decision, I suppose, but I'm just trying to point out that there are ways to change the language so that juveniles are included as much as they should be in this section.
Would you want to refer to discussions regarding disposition?
Well, It would be probably regarding plea negotiations or disposition involving any violent felonies or adjudications on violent felonies. But there are ways to do it and take out the definition regarding criminal defendant and including juveniles in that, which would be more accurate and would actually make sure that the juveniles are included the way they should be. If juveniles were included in HJR 87 the way they should be, Juvenile Rights Project would not only support this being referred out to the voters, once in the election we would be supporting its passage because we feel that that would be important and those are actual victims' rights, which should be afforded to victims of juveniles who are adjudicated as delinquent acts. On HJR 88...
Let me interrupt you again. As to criminal defendant, what was the phraseology you were recommending before? alleged perpetrator?
Person
charged?
Right. The corresponding language for criminal defendant in juvenile court would be, technically would be a youth. But since youth has a broader meaning out in the community, what my suggestion was alleged youth offenders. In the juvenile code, youth is defined as an alleged youth offender. But considering the broader meaning, it's probably better to use alleged youth offender.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at what has been handed out to us, which I think may be what went down to LC for the amendments. This is the from staff, and it looks like it does use that phrase because it says criminal defendants includes alleged youth offenders in juvenile court delinquency proceedings. Is that, do you have that?
Yes, I do. What my suggestion is you don't need that definition of criminal defendant includes alleged youth offenders or convicted criminal includes youth offenders, because in the subsection 1 language you can put it in there so that definition is not even needed, and it's very clear throughout subsection 1 that what you mean are both the criminals that are in adult court and the youth offenders that are in juvenile court, with the corresponding equivalent language of juvenile court within subsection 1.
What if we simply took out the youth offender description or whatever else and used the generic language in regard to crime, and then had a separate section that simply said something to the effect that the rights granted to a victim as to an adult criminal defendant shall be the same for any victim as to a juvenile or an alleged youth offender in juvenile court?
That would probably work. You'd probably want to also say something along the lines that is in subsection 1B, where it said, where the language I suggested was added, where it says equivalent information regarding the alleged youth offender, so that there's some explanation on that, only because all of those terms, conviction, sentence, imprisonment, criminal history, are not used in juvenile court.
All right, thank you. Go ahead.
I'll skip over HJR 88 because juveniles have been taken out of that because of the they aren't given a jury trial in Oregon. And also HJR 89, juveniles have been taken out of. On HJR 90, juveniles are still included in this, and there is a problem with that because subsection B, 1B, talks about bail. Juveniles don't have a right to bail in Oregon. Throughout that bail section, it doesn't mention juveniles, but then down in subsection 3, again, you have the definition of criminal defendant including juveniles. So the reading of this would be essentially saying that juveniles, that certain offenses for juveniles are not bailable, which would, I think, give a reading that perhaps other offenses are bailable in juvenile court. The juvenile code includes a very extensive list of what the court is to consider when releasing juveniles. It's much more kind of, the juvenile release statute is much more formalized. In other words, court, you first have to make this finding. If you make this finding, then you can still hold the child if you can find one of these three things. If you can find one of those three things, you can still release the child if you find these things. And in fact, this legislature is going to be adding to that in all probability because of the mandatory hold bills for juveniles that are bringing guns to school adds to a condition of the court needs to consider the mental health of the youth. So it's a very extensive list, much more extensive than is in the adult criminal code regarding release of adult criminals. My suggestion is to leave that statute the way it is, because I think it works pretty well and allows juvenile departments to manage their their detention beds very well, and it says essentially you can hold on all felonies, and then misdemeanors that involve a threat of harm to another or use of a firearm. So it is very extensive on what juvenile courts can hold kids on. On HJR 91, excuse me, again, we have the definition of criminal defendant including youth offenders, and again you have a language problem in subsection A where you're talking about guilt, sentence, or criminal cases. Again, that would be a problem, that could be a problem. I don't think in this case, however, you actually need to include juveniles in this section for language purposes, because there are U.S. Supreme Court cases that say that the due process rights given to adult criminal defendants are the same due process rights that must be given to juveniles. These are U.S. Supreme Court cases from the early 1960s, so I don't expect that they're going to be overturned anytime soon. And if the Oregon Constitution bars evidence in a criminal defendant's case, that's by the analysis of those cases, it would also bar the evidence in juvenile delinquency cases. So I don't think you need to add juveniles to this section, and they would still be covered by this section, given the case law, the United States Supreme Court case law.
Well, one might say that if we weren't clear about including juveniles, I could see the Oregon Supreme Court saying, aha, we've been restricted as to the application of certain doctrines as to adults, but we don't see a similar restriction here as to juvenile proceedings, so we'll follow our short-term honored 13-year analysis as to what evidence is appropriate in search and seizure, for example, for juveniles, and so we'll have the bifurcation will then be between adults and juveniles in Oregon. I'm just wondering out loud.
Mr. Chair, certainly there is the possibility of that, I suppose, but given the fact that on Miranda cases, there's a lot of evidence and a lot of studies that have been done that juveniles don't understand the Miranda warnings and actually tend to waive their Miranda warnings at an alarmingly higher rate than adults waive their Miranda rights. And the U.S. and the Oregon Supreme Court has not found it necessary to have a separate test for juveniles regarding waiver of Miranda versus the adults regarding waiver of Miranda. Additionally, the Oregon Supreme Court has not found it necessary to have different standards for searching. And Oregon is one of the few states in the country that does not require that a parent consent to a police officer questioning a juvenile prior to the police officer being able to question the juvenile. Where many other states do have that requirement, and the Oregon that has been posed to the Oregon appellate courts, and they have not found it they have not gone that way to bifurcate those areas in terms of what's required for a juvenile and what's required for an adult. So I don't know that there is that judicial history that they would do it. I suppose it certainly is possible, but I have not seen the trend regarding the difference them wanting the difference in other areas.
All right, thank you.
I would skip over HJR 92 because, again, that deals with juries, and juveniles are not included in that, and there's not the section of the definition, the problem with the definition. In HJR 93, again, you have the definition of the criminal defendant, which causes problems in subsection 1A, where it says a person may be prosecuted and convicted, even if the person has been compelled. Juveniles are not... I guess technically they are prosecuted, but they certainly are not convicted. Again, this is language that you could solve this problem by putting the juvenile language into the section and just getting rid of that definition, because when you put the definition in, although it makes it obvious that criminal defendant means that, the problem then comes up with the other corresponding language not being followed through. HJR 94 actually creates one of the biggest problems regarding juveniles of all of these, and that's the inclusion of juveniles, not the court, that no law shall permit a term of imprisonment or commitment to be set aside.
I think you can assume that that will be removed.
Okay. That is something that I know that the Oregon Youth Authority has asked to be removed, and also the juvenile director, so it's not just a defense attorney request here.
In the next version, we, at least some of us, have talked about that, and we've talked to some of the proponents, and we've explained that we think that ought to be removed. I shouldn't assume anything in this process, but the proposal will be to remove that.
I have nothing further unless the committee has any questions.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testifying. Mr. Fedanke, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fedanke, Executive Director of American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. Mr. Chair, as you are fully aware, I urged when I testified before this committee back in February that HR 7 be split into separate proposals.
Now, you're not going to tell me that 8 is not enough, are you?
No, I'm not, Mr. Chair. In fact, I think it may be too many.
From a certain perspective, we can understand.
And, Mr. Chair, I wanted to start by expressing my appreciation for the fact that these proposals are now back before the committee. I believe that the work you are currently engaged in certainly has the potential to be every bit as important as the work that the framers of the Oregon Constitution did back in 1857. This is a book titled The Oregon Constitution and Proceedings and Debates of the Constitutional Convention of 1857, which was drawn from newspaper accounts of that process. There is precious little in this extensive volume concerning the framers' considerations of the Oregon Bill of Rights. And I know that there are scholars who are have been for some time now poring over other original documents from that time, trying to shed light on the intent of the framers. This process has had light shined on it from far, far brighter than was shining on the deliberations around the Oregon Bill of Rights back in 1857. But the proposals in front of this committee, if adopted by the people, will have very remarkable consequences for decades and perhaps even centuries to come. And we know, Mr. Chair, that you are aware of that responsibility. We know that other committee members are cognizant of that responsibility. And I want to once again urge you this morning to go through this process carefully, because as you've heard from prior testimony, amending the Constitution, amending in particular the Oregon Bill of Rights, can have unintended consequences. I have distributed to the committee this morning most of, not all of, the current version of the Oregon Bill of Rights. I haven't distributed to you the original Oregon Bill of Rights, but I want to refer to some of these provisions. And as background, Mr. Chair, the other thing that I urged the committee to do back in February when I appeared before you was not only to split these measures out into separate bills so that the legislature would have a chance to vote up or down on the merits of each proposal, but also to eliminate language which is unnecessary from each of these proposals, to hone in on the changes you are attempting to make. Again, Mr. Chair, the ACLU is going to disagree philosophically, I assume, with the policy choices, or at least many of the policy choices this committee may choose to make, to the extent that it endorses proposals that were contained in Ballot Measure 40. Nevertheless, I think there's a right way and a wrong way to do it if you're going to go ahead and do it. And I would strongly urge you to look at the existing language of the Oregon Constitution. Think about the policy change you're attempting to implement and do it in as clear and as straightforward a manner as possible. Ms. Chair, as I move through some of the specific proposals now, I am working off of the staff draft that was distributed here on Monday, which is undated, but which has HJR's 87 through 94. To start with, the ACLU has no objection to HJR 87. I expect that we will support it when it appears on the ballot. We believe that these protections for crime victims, to incorporate them and accommodate their needs in the criminal justice process, are good, and that that may well represent a change from ACLU's position back in 1984 when some of these proposals were first put forward. I think that is in large part a measure of the effect that this ongoing debate about quote-unquote victims' rights has had on everyone that cares about our criminal justice process. I believe the remainder of the changes that are being proposed in HJRs 88 through 94 do not relate directly to the rights of victims. I understand completely the proponents of Measure 40's belief that these changes are necessary from their point of view in order to metamorphosize, whatever the word might be, the criminal justice process to be more victim-friendly. But what each of these proposals is attempting to accomplish is a change to an existing provision in the Oregon Bill of Rights. In some cases, just a change to an interpretation of an existing provision of the Oregon Bill of Rights. In other situations, an actual change in wording that I believe would be much more effectively accomplished if you look at the current provisions in the Oregon Bill of Rights. And let's start with HJR 88. This issue of the people of the state of Oregon, and I believe the effective sentence in HJR 88 comes at the end of subsection 1, which is in bold in the draft that I have. The people of the state of Oregon have the right to a public trial by jury without delay in any criminal prosecution. Now, that policy choice, I think, could be accomplished very easily by an amendment to Article 1, Section 11. And now I'll refer you to the current copy of the Oregon Bill of Rights that I passed out this morning. The operative language here, which has been testified to now on several occasions by the proponents of this measure, comes down towards the bottom of the page. Provided, however, that any accused person in other than capital cases with the consent of the trial judge may elect to waive the trial by jury and consent to be tried by the judge of the court, such election to be in writing. Now, that provision, as has also been testified to, was adopted after an amendment was proposed by the legislature in 1931. It's adopted by the people in 1932. A number of changes were made to Article 1, Section 11 in that amendment in 1932. What the proponents of this measure have said they want is to prevent a criminal defendant from waiving their right to a jury trial without the consent of the state. without the consent of the district attorney. All you have to do to accomplish that is insert in the current language, with the consent of the trial judge and the state. That's all you have to do. You don't have to have all of this other language in HJR 88. It could be accomplished very simply, very cleanly. If you did it that way, everyone would know that what you were doing was saying that a defendant could not waive their right to a jury trial without the consent of both the judge and the prosecution. That, I think, is what the proponents want to accomplish. By adding all this other language in HJR 88, all that they accomplish is to create confusion about when and how this provision might apply. Because by putting it in the context of victims' rights, you have to put in all this other stuff about, well, it's really not the victim that has this right. It is the prosecution, which is going to be given a veto over a defendant's right to waive a jury trial. So I'm just pointing this out as one example of how I think some of these policy choices can be pursued without putting needless language into our Bill of Rights that are just going to cause confusion. There is another portion of HJR 88, which I think is...
I'm going to interrupt for a moment,
yeah,
if I may. First, I'll mention to folks who are waiting to see what, when and where we get to firearms. I understand it's being dealt with downstairs, and so I'm going to sort of move it. I don't have any update, but that's just my general understanding. So I'm going to be handling that substantially later this morning and hearing from people. So if you need to be downstairs, you can go down there now and not worry. It'll be at least an hour before we get to it. Excuse me, Mr. Representative Kozanski.
Mr. Denke, regarding that first, before we change our thoughts, so your thought is to go in and have a proposal to the people for Section 11 to insert basically that it would have to be with the consent of the trial judge and the district attorney
and
of the state.
And the state. I mean, okay. The district attorney is the one who acts on behalf of the state. Okay. Either way, I mean, that would make sense. I think it would... It is a policy choice the ACLU opposes, but I'm just trying to get across to you that there are, I think, simple, clean ways to make some of these changes that also would have the benefit of showing the voters what changes are being made to the existing provisions of the Oregon Constitution, rather than putting a whole new section where, frankly, most people aren't going to be able to figure out what this is even doing, because it's buried at the end of a paragraph in a section of other stuff that doesn't directly relate.
And your analysis of looking at doing this, do you believe that that would be an amendment or a revision?
I believe that would be an amendment, Mr. Chairman, Representative Prusansky. And what I don't know is the next question. Because there are other measures that are now broken out separately that would affect changes to Article 1, Section 11. And it seems to me that it may, if the amendment in 1932 was permissible, then it seems to me by implication that you could make all of those changes to Article 1, Section 11 in one ballot measure, show the people what changes you were making, and possibly collapse two or three of these proposals into one amendment to the Constitution. The ACLU has argued that some changes to the Bill of Rights would be so fundamental that they would amount to a revision of the Constitution. We made that argument with regard to I believe it was Section 2 of Measure 40, which was the lockstep provision tying Article 1, Section 9 and Article 1, Section 12 to the federal Constitution's interpretation. we argued that that was a fundamental shift in the way a state constitution is designed, because, and maybe I should get back to that, but I don't think some of these technical changes to jury provisions would necessarily be a revision. I may be wrong, but I don't think they would. If you wanted to be sure, then get 40 votes in the House and 20 votes in the Senate, or 17, but whatever. The math is, I'm not quite awake yet, Mr. Chair, please forgive me, and insulated against an attack as a revision. But I don't think by merely making changes to the Oregon Bill of Rights necessarily are revising the Constitution. I think that's certainly not what we have argued in court.
Thank you.
My final point, Mr. Chair, on H.J.R. 88 is that I believe the provision inserting the phrase "without delay" in that sentence after the right to a public trial by jury is unnecessary. Article 1, Section 10, and again I'm referring back to the current Constitution, provides no court shall be secret, but justice shall be administered openly and without purchase, completely and without delay. That language is already in our Oregon Bill of Rights. I don't believe there are any cases that have permitted excessive delays. If what the purpose of adding that language here is to again give to the state the power of to veto a defendant's request to postpone a trial date, then I think that would more clearly be accomplished within the context of Article 1, Section 11 by adding another phrase or sentence there.
I should mention that the intention is not to veto the power of the defendant to seek a delay, but to ensure balance that if at some point the defendant is saying, well, I'm the only one who has the right to a speedy trial, and statutorily the district attorney may be able to push for a speedy trial, but my constitutional right to due process requires that I be given complete leeway as the criminal defendant. I'm just making up an argument here. Allows me to seek further delays, and you can't take that away from me. This counterbalances it by saying, well, wait a minute, the victim also has a right to see a speedy trial. And yes, that has to be balanced through the due process considerations, but at some point, delay, too, could be considered to be inappropriate, even though the defendant may want it. At some point, you say, enough of this, the trial will proceed. Granted, the statutory scheme allows it right now. This would put that balancing principle into the Constitution also.
Mr. Chair, again, I think the committee needs to think about how is this going to be implemented. Is it a right that you want to give to the victim to object specifically to a postponement of the trial, or is it something that you want, a power you want to give to the state through the district attorney to object to a postponement of a trial?
Really, the way it's set up is that's the way it works.
Currently, a postponement is not automatic if a defendant requests it. It's up to the discretion of the trial court judge.
I suppose I just mentioned, for instance, parenthetically, then I'll shut up and let you get on here, the Kip Kinkle situation in Springfield. The system presumes Mr. Kinkle's innocence, and he is entitled to a fair trial with that presumption of innocence. On the other hand, if news media accounts are accurate, there's probably 100 eyewitnesses to seeing him shooting people in a school cafeteria. And at some point, the public outrage about the fact that today is May 5th, this event occurred May 21 a year ago, we're almost reaching the first anniversary of the event. It's understood and accepted that a certain number of things have to happen in the defense of that case. His mental state at the time, his mental state now, has to be evaluated. But how long does this justice system keep churning over those issues? And I'm not saying that anything inappropriate is being done in that case right now, but as time marches on, one wonders where the pressures are to get to a trial and an adjudication. And I just mention that because that's in the news. There could be examples all over the place. On the other hand, the defendant, too, has a right not to be stewing and waiting. And when you read about someone having a case hanging for 2 or 3 years, there must be a terrible experience waiting for that trial. I'll let Kathy Osborne comment on my comments, and then we'll go back to Mr. Kodanky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to point out to the committee that another problem regarding the speed of any trial is the docket, the entire docket of any county court, and the availability of judges to hear the trial. It's not just how long it takes the defense to get ready or even the prosecution to get ready. Oftentimes both sides could be ready and there just isn't a judge available. And I would also point out to the committee that I have friends who are I know a lot of criminal defense attorneys around the country, and they are just amazed at how quickly our cases actually do go to trial. Our Oregon actually has one of the more speedy trial calendars in the country. Oftentimes, I hear from my friends of people who are waiting 2 or 3 years on a simple robbery trial, where certainly in Multnomah County, in 120 days, you're going to be pushed to go to trial on a robbery case, if not sooner. Take that into consideration, that Oregon actually does a pretty good job at getting cases out to trial.
Fair comment. Mr. Panenki, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving on to HCR 89, which is the jury provision, and I actually did not copy for you the current jury provision in the Oregon Constitution, which shows up under the section for the judicial branch. But again, I would encourage you to add this language or modify the existing language of that portion of the Constitution rather than setting up a separate provision. So that, again, the voters can see what changes specifically are being made, and so they can be as clean and as efficient as possible. I think we've made our views known on these issues very clearly. We are opposed to both policy choices, but we certainly understand the reasons behind them and the support for those changes by the proponents. Moving on to HCR 90, which is rewrite of the current bail provisions in the Oregon Bill of Rights, which are contained in Article 1, Section 14, and that's on the second page of the current version of the Oregon Bill of Rights, which I distributed to the committee. The current provision in Article 1, Section 14 is pretty straightforward. Offenses except murder and treason shall be bailable by sufficient sureties. Murder or treason shall not be bailable when proof is evident or the presumption strong. Now, there's nothing there. Let's just focus in on the murder and treason provision. There's nothing there about all the hoops that the prosecution has to jump through. It's pretty straightforward. The government has to show that the proof is evident or the presumption strong in order to deny bail to someone accused of murder or treason. In some ways, I think the fascination with what is required by the federal constitution in order to make a change to this bail provision comply with the federal constitution has got you all looking at the trees rather than the forest. I think you can probably make the changes that the proponents of Measure 40 want made in a relatively straightforward manner if you do it by changing Article 1, Section 14. Again, we strongly oppose those policy choices. But I think essentially what the committee wants to do is to expand the list of non-bailable offenses or have an intermediary step for certain offenses that will not automatically be bailable by sufficient sureties without consideration of these other characteristics. Is that clear, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krasanski.
Before you go to the next one, Mr. Krasanski, we went from 88 to 90. Were you going to have comments on 89?
Oh, did I skip one?
Or did you cover that?
I think I did deal with 89 just by saying that we think those changes ought to be made to the existing provisions in the judicial branch if you're going to make those changes. We oppose those policy choices, but
right.
If you're going to do it, there's a section in the portion of the Constitution dealing with the power of the judicial branch that delegates responsibility to the legislature to determine the qualifications of jurors. If different qualifications are going to be adopted, then we would say that would be the appropriate place to insert it in the Constitution. I'm not looking at that section of the Constitution right now, Representative, so I'm not sure the exact...
I just want to get clarification.
Yeah.
Talking about Article 7, which is under the Judicial Department, and then there's a couple of sections dealing with juries, but whichever would be appropriate as to their qualifications to sit as a juror.
Right, and there are actually two... There's an Article 7 original and an Article 7 amended, so you need to be sure you're looking at the Article 7 amended.
Yeah, amended I am. It looks like there's a Section 5, juries, indictments, information, verdict in civil cases. Then there's one down below, Section 9, juries of less than 12 jurors.
Mm-hmm.
And the jury trial in Section 3.
Okay. There's another section. I'm sorry that I hadn't found it earlier, Mr. Chair and Representative Krasanski, but I certainly can and flag that for the committee.
Thank
it's
you.
Sometimes hard to find some of these obscure provisions.
We've got copies right back here anyway.
Moving on to HJR 91. How was I on 90? Thought I finished at 90. I think I had made the points I wanted to make on HJR 90. HJR 91 of all of these proposals is the one that the ACLU feels most strongly about. In opposition. And I'll go into some of what I alluded to earlier. When state constitutions were created, when our state constitution was created back in 1857, the Federal Bill of Rights did not apply to the states. Our state Bill of Rights was and continues to be our primary protection of liberty in the state of Oregon. I certainly understand that we have a philosophical disagreement with the proponents of Ballot Measure 40 and with many members of this committee regarding how Article 1, Section 9, the Oregon Search and Seizure Clause, the Oregon Search or Seizure Clause, has been interpreted by Oregon courts. And there is disagreement about the history of that interpretation. You've heard testimony in earlier hearings that, in fact, the Oregon Supreme Court had interpreted Article 1, Section 9 of our Constitution differently from the way the U.S. Supreme Court had interpreted the Fourth Amendment going way, way back in Oregon case law. I did some research 10, 15 years ago to try to look at some of those early cases and compare the analysis to some of the early search and seizure cases at the federal level. There weren't a lot of cases. But even when there were cases, there were major differences in how this provision was interpreted. The language is very similar to the federal Fourth Amendment. It's not identical. The Fourth Amendment talks about searches and seizures. The Oregon Constitution talks about searches or seizures. And in fact, the court, the Oregon courts have read some significance into that change in one word. And I understand we have a disagreement philosophically, Mr. Chair, with you and others about whether Oregon's Constitution should be interpreted to provide greater protection for Oregonians than is required now by the federal Constitution. But to adopt this provision, which for all time, unless changed at some future date by the voters or at the request of the legislature, to tie for all time the interpretation of the privacy rights of Oregonians to how the federal Constitution has been interpreted by the federal courts, by the U.S. Supreme Court and other federal judges who are unelected, who are not answerable to Oregon voters, we believe is a dangerous move for the liberty of Oregonians. If what you want to do is change the interpretation, is force the Oregon Supreme Court to change its interpretation of Article 1, Section 9, then I would suggest you focus in on the language. And how would you change it? What standard would you have judges apply if it is a standard that is different from what is contained in the Oregon Constitution? I would maintain that the way that Article 1, Section 9 has been interpreted historically by the Oregon Supreme Court is much more consistent with the history of this country, with the history of this state, than the interpretation of the federal Fourth Amendment in recent years by the U.S. Supreme Court. And we get into esoteric discussions about general searches, writs of assistance that were carried out by the king's troops and by authorities acting under the crown in colonial times when government officials, British officials, actually went into colonial courts to get general warrants that allowed them to search anywhere, any place, any person that they suspected of engaging in criminal conduct, or not even criminal conduct, smuggling, trying to avoid payment of customs duties. And as much as anything, the outrage of the colonists to that practice of being searched when there was no individualized suspicion that they had done something wrong led to the revolution, the American Revolution, and the specific language of the Fourth Amendment. But here we are at the end of the 20th century. Most searches are not carried out by warrants. They're carried out under exigent circumstances. And more, the courts, the federal courts, are turning a blind eye and saying as long as government officials are acting with noble intentions, it's okay to seize and search citizens who may have done something wrong or may not have done something wrong.
Well, we need to pause for a moment, Mr. Podanky, and recall, too, that the dynamic changes in society during that time, there were no motor vehicles available for getaway cars. There may have been horses. At the other end of the spectrum, though, we also did not have the exclusionary rule, which was a court-established method for enforcing these rights against unreasonable searches or seizures. And Oregon, yes, did apply the exclusionary rule on its own time frame. So the next question is, with the next, the last 30 years of further dynamic changes, where police officers no longer have a sixth grade education or less, at least in this state, we have a certification and training process, we have a disciplinary process, we have all these other devices, including civil rights laws and the right to bring civil suit, the right to bring all kinds of enforcement actions against inappropriate police activity, including a private civil suit if necessary, that we've created a whole structure of protections tied around the concept of unreasonable searches or seizures. And then the question is whether or not Oregon ought to have a harder to define, almost indeterminate in the view of some, exclusionary rule as to certain searches and seizures, which is harder to understand than the federal. And I'm just pointing this out to say that there are some dynamics at work here, and there is a reason and a methodology involved here to say we're not going to see the exclusionary rule apply differently in Oregon. This doesn't say that other remedies won't be available, and I need to finally add, the legislature or the people through the initiative by enacting a statute can still set a higher standard. They can even set a tough exclusionary rule by statute. What this is a reflection of, and I will be honest about it, is a certain amount of distrust of the judiciary in Oregon when they decide that their prerogative to interpret the Constitution has been infringed on in any way, then they will go off and do whatever they can to rephrase and reinterpret. And this is why, in reaction, some of us said, we're going to tie this then to an interpretation by other judges, which we acknowledge and which you've pointed out, which is not a fun thing to do. We know that we can never have a lesser standard of protection in Oregon. We can create higher standards of protection by statute if we wish, but we're concerned that the judges who until 19, I remember 1973, State versus Vasquez, I think it was, the judges of the Supreme Court were saying, I get that time they were in the mode of saying, well, we're going to interpret this the same as the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution, and for several years that was in place, then they shifted again. That's not a very reliable process either. Now, I recognize you don't agree with that. I'm just pointing out that there is a rationale behind this, and that'll be...
I understand that, Mr. Chair, and just to close on this point, this legislature... I was here 2 years ago arguing against a provision in Senate Bill 936 that prohibited the exclusion of evidence when the police violated a statute in collecting that evidence. I think much of the displeasure with the Oregon Supreme Court's decisions in the search and seizure area resulted from decisions to exclude evidence based on statutory violations rather than constitutional violations. That now has been changed. We strongly opposed that legislation. We urged the governor to veto it. He signed it into law. It is now law in Oregon. We've not yet seen how that is going to be interpreted by the Oregon Supreme Court. I think that, if allowed to play out, will either confirm your worst fears that the Oregon Supreme Court is just looking for an opportunity to lord itself over the legislature and over law enforcement, or to see whether, in fact, the Oregon Supreme Court got the message. I think they have good ears across the way, and have seen what is coming. I mean, what is at stake is nothing less than our state constitutional rights of privacy, the closest thing we have to them. And I understand your frustration. I understand the frustration of prosecutors and of Crime Victims United and other supporters of Measure 40. But I would ask you again, to think not the last 10 years, not the last 20 years, but think the next 200 years. Is this rule going to work well when U.S. Supreme Court justices have thrown out more of the Fourth Amendment? Will we have a legislature in place then that is willing to reinstate these rights? How will they be interpreted then in light of the fact that this earlier case law was thrown out by this amendment to the Constitution. Once we give up our liberty, it is very difficult to get it back. And I just want to urge you to be very, very cautious in this area, because I think this is the most far-reaching of any of these proposals. And as I said earlier, it is the one that we oppose the strongest. Moving on to HJR 92.
Mr. Fedenke, I need to mention, I do have people coming back as they're looking to some other. Do you think another 8 minutes or so will do?
I think so, Mr. Chair. The non-unanimous jury provision in HJR 92. Again, we oppose this from a policy standpoint, but if you want to accomplish the goal, which I assume here is to permit a verdict of guilty when only 11 members of a jury agree to vote guilty, this language does not say that clearly. You could make a change. If, again, you look at Article 1, Section 11, and it's at the top of the second page that I've given you. Provided, however, that in the circuit court, 10 members of the jury may render a verdict of guilty or not guilty, save and except a verdict of guilty of first-degree murder, which shall be found only by a unanimous verdict. I think you could change that language to accomplish what you want to accomplish here, what the proponents of Measure 40 wanted to accomplish, without having an entirely separate provision of the Bill of Rights that is framed in the context of rights of crime victims, where you are really just trying to say that in addition to circuit court verdicts generally being found by 10 members rather than unanimously, there is another category of offenses in which a verdict of guilty can be returned by 11 members of the jury. Get rid of this language at the end of this operative section, but all 12 jurors must render a verdict of guilty for aggravated murder. You've already got a provision in the Constitution which says very clearly that save and accept a verdict of guilty of first-degree murder, which you could change from first-degree to aggravated and conform to Oregon law as it is currently written. And I would point out the current language, which shall be found only by a unanimous verdict, I think is clearer than saying all 12 jurors must render a verdict of guilty. Literally, the language that's proposed here prohibits a jury in a murder case from coming back with any other verdict than guilty. That's not what anyone intends, but that's what it says. So at least write it in a way that it says what you mean. With regard to HJR 93, again, this is an attempt, I believe, to rewrite Article 1, Section 12, which currently reads, no person shall be put in jeopardy twice for the same offense, nor be compelled in any criminal prosecution to testify against himself. If what you are trying to accomplish is to change the Oregon Supreme Court's interpretation of that section, then just amend that section and get rid of all the surplus language.
I think, Mr. Fedenke, there's one qualification here. The reason for the all 12 jurors must render a verdict of guilty, I believe the idea there is that you can still have a 10-2 acquittal.
Right.
But if you want to have guilt, you must have 12-0.
My point, Mr. Chair, is that the current language of the Oregon Constitution already accomplishes that. And so I think all you need to do is change first degree to aggravated, and you've done it.
Blended in is what you're bringing up.
Yeah.
I understand that. Okay, go ahead, please.
Again, with regard to HR 93, the current language of Article 1, Section 12, we believe, we support its interpretation as it has been interpreted by the Oregon Supreme Court. We believe that interpretation is much more consistent with the history, and that's not just American history regarding self-incrimination and compulsion of testimony. That history was covered extensively in a scholarly work by Leonard Levy called The Origins of the Fifth Amendment. It literally goes back to the Middle Ages in Great Britain, and was one of those rights that was fought for over centuries under British jurisprudence. We would discourage you from tossing it aside, as the U.S. Supreme Court tossed it aside in a 5-4 vote on the use immunity issue back in the 70s. Finally, on HR 94, I think all the prior testimony you've heard has pointed out the technical problems with that. I don't have anything further to add to the wise counsel you've already received, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your patience with my testimony this morning. I hope it's helpful as you continue your deliberations.
We always find it helpful. Thank you both very much.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, excuse me. Representative Pozanski has a question.
I just need to get back to one of these other questions.
Thank you. I guess I want to go back to the point on the jury service. This is HJR 89, if I'm right. Maybe it was 90.
I think it was 89 that you were asking about
before.
Yeah.
Looking at the Articles 7, Section 5, and this talks about juries, and it says basically the legislative assembly shall provide bylaw 4 and then A, selecting jury and qualifications for jurors. That's what you're referring to.
Yes.
But I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, you know, since we already have placed into the Constitution this delegation of power to the assembly, why we would want to go in and make that modification into the Constitution as compared to just staying on the statutory, realizing that sometime in the future, as we have today a proposed change, there may be another proposed change to come where the legislature is going to basically be disempowered from being able to make whatever judgments, wise or unwise, in the future.
It's a good question, Representative Pozanski. I think part of the answer lies in the long-term predictability as to jury composition. The other might be said to have been a reaction by the public to the legislature's evident incapability to reflect their preferences as to jury composition when the legislature removed certain restrictions on jury membership by changing the time-honored process that required that you be a registered voter. And the voters didn't refer that measure out to the referral power, but we could set certain baseline standards in the Constitution. And it's really a philosophical question as to what the baseline standards ought to be. And this gives the people the power to decide that they want that baseline standard or that they don't.
But it would seem that we, as the legislature, at this time in the current environment, you know, if those changes are ones that we want to move forward, they should be done through the Republican form of government and make these changes there, so if in the future, based on a difference in a public opinion, poll, or philosophy, that their elected officials will in fact be able to carry that out without burdening the citizenry with another vote and another change to the Constitution.
Okay, noted.
And Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that, I I appreciate that it's a policy choice at this point for the legislature to make. Originally, it was a policy choice that the proponents of Measure 40 made. If it is your desire to lock that into the Constitution, my point was do it in Article 7 rather than in a separate provision that leaves that existing provision in place but would be in conflict with it. If what you're trying to do is limit the ability of future legislatures to modify qualifications for jurors, or to at least set a baseline below which the legislature cannot go, or make it clear that that's also not the standard above which the legislature can go, give the legislature, retain the legislature's flexibility to make changes as long as they're consistent with that provision. And I think you can accomplish that in Article 7 much more cleanly, so that there will be fewer unintended consequences. As you know, we believe that tying jury service to registration to vote raises constitutional problems under the federal Constitution, and are opposed to that on policy grounds. But if that's the policy choice you want to make, that's the way we would suggest you do it.
Thank you very much. This concludes the work session on HGR 87 through 94, the combined work session. Colleagues, do you need a break, or are we? All right, we'll take a recess till about 9:30. We're in recess.